Deutschlandfunk Kultur Feature.
Was passiert, wenn eine ganz normale Bürgerin schwarzer Hautfarbe nichts anderes tun will, als sich für die Wahl registrieren zu lassen? Das hören wir in dieser dritten Folge von This Little Light, unserer deutschen Neuvorstellung einer wegweisenden, aber viel zu wenig bekannten US-Doku-Serie aus dem Jahr 1964. Und wir hören von Aufbrüchen. Ein Schulboykott und die Gründung einer neuen Partei setzen Zeichen und haben Folgen.
We present part three of This Little Light, a series of documentaries on Mississippi in 1964.
This Little Light, eine Radioserie aus dem Jahr 1964 von Chris Koch. Neu gehört und in Ausschnitten präsentiert von Martina Groß. Teil 3: Aufbrüche.
The Shaw boycott was a direct outgrowth of the freedom schools, you know, and yeah, it was very, very moving and dramatic. Again, I don't know how it ever turned out, but the whole community was mobilized.
I would like to say to the school who cooperated with us today, we had 100% cooperation of the high school department. Now, in the near future, in fact, tomorrow, we must have that same cooperation. Now, I believe that Charles stated that we're not going to class tomorrow. Is that what he said?
Yeah.
All right. Now, I had a report that said if the student don't come to class tomorrow, then he was going to close his school down. But now, you must look at this. If Mr. Altimer closes his school down, the student will have 3 weeks this summer to rest. But Mr. Altimer will have 3 weeks of hell.
Mit den Freedom Schools im Sommer 1964 wurde die junge Generation angesprochen. Viele der Lehrer waren übrigens nicht viel älter als ihre Schüler. Schon im Frühjahr 1964 hatten sich schwarze Schüler zur Mississippi Student Union zusammengeschlossen, um für bessere Bildungschancen zu kämpfen. Aaron German ist einer von ihnen. Er geht in die McEvans High School in Shaw, einer Kleinstadt im Delta, in der die Zeit seit der großen Depression stehen geblieben scheint. Zumindest im schwarzen Stadtteil.
Shaw is a Mississippi Delta town, a small rural community in Bolivar County, north of Indianola and east of Greenville. It is cotton country, low, flat, hot and humid. Huge cotton fields with mile-long rows stretch in every direction, broken at their borders by rows and clumps of Delta vegetation. The cotton was low in August of 1964. It was a bad crop, but the pale yellow flowers in blossom when I drove through the fields are beautiful until you know the price that has been paid to raise them. Shaw is divided into white and black, and the black part of town strikes anyone who drives into it for the first time, like Morris Rubin, a school teacher from New York City who was one of the summer volunteers assigned to the Shaw Freedom School.
My initial impression of Shaw was amazement. I didn't know that there were still places like Shaw, or there were places like Shaw in the United States. There was a street without any pavement. There was an open sewer. There were chickens running back and forth across the road. There were houses that weren't painted. There was one house with a Model A Ford parked alongside it. It reminded me very much of photographs taken by Ben Shahn and others during the 30s.
Like many volunteers, Morris Rubin heard about the project during the winter of 1963. Then at the training session in Oxford, Ohio, he asked to be sent to a rural area and was assigned as a freedom school teacher in Shaw. The regular school in Shaw, McEvan, is no better than any other Negro school in Mississippi. The building is spanking new and handsome, newer in fact than the white school at the other side of town. But the laboratories are without test tubes or equipment. The shop has been converted into another classroom. There is no cold water fountain nor lockers.
Im Folgenden hören wir Ausschnitte aus Gesprächen mit Schülern der McEvans High School. Das Schuljahr der schwarzen Kids richtete sich übrigens nach der Arbeit auf den Baumwollfeldern. Deswegen drücken sie mitten im Sommer die Schulbank.
We don't go to school when school starts in the summer, starts in July. And we go to school July and August. And sometimes, if school don't start like it's supposed to start in July, then we have to go to school in the first part of September. And then we'll be out the rest of the part of September and October and go back in November.
Why are you out in September and October?
Pig cat.
And why are you out in June and last part of May?
We're out to chop cotton.
As we said, SNCC had been in the Delta for 2 years, and one of the organizations established in the high schools was the Mississippi Student Union.
The Mississippi Student Union was a group of students gotten together. They had gotten together and organized themselves. And we were trying to work on getting the parents to really participate in the movement, which was the main problem.
Do you remember when that was formed?
The Student Union had just been going for a few months, but we started participating in the movement in 62.
It was in this context that a seemingly unimportant incident took place in the middle of August.
Hier kommt es im Sommer 1964 nach einem Fußballspiel zu einem Vorfall, der zum ersten Schulboykott in Mississippi führt. Zum Fußballspiel waren auch die jungen Freiwilligen eingeladen. Als sie nach dem Spiel gemeinsam zu einem Spendendinner gehen, dürfen die Weißen nicht in der Schulcafeteria essen. Dafür brauchen sie eine Erlaubnis. Die Rassentrennung schränkt auch das Miteinander von Schwarzen und Weißen ein. Spontan rufen die Schüler zum Boykott ihrer Schule auf, an denen sie gleich Forderungen nach besseren Lernbedingungen anschließen. Und sie nutzen die Gelegenheit, ihre Eltern mit einzubeziehen.
Well, on a Friday afternoon we had a football game. About 95 degree weather. And we had invited the volunteers over to the game. They came over and they were rooting for McEwen's Warriors, and then we asked them to come to a fundraising dinner we were having. So they went over there for the dinner and they bought it. And the cook asked them to come inside the cafeteria and eat.
The lady who was in charge of the cafeteria first asked us to come in and sit down and eat there. And it was this time that Mr. Altheimer, the principal, told us we couldn't eat there. We would have to get permission from the superintendent. And we found out his office was in Shaw, and by that time our spaghetti would get cold. So we turned around and we ate our dinner on the step going into the cafeteria.
Some of the kids came out there and asked them what happened. And they said we were asked out of the cafeteria. And everybody said we were boycotted, just like that.
The kids said that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so we boycotted. Mm-hmm.
So now Shaw too, like communities throughout Mississippi, has found an issue on which to build an organization and a movement for social change. To what extent did the Freedom School program contribute to these changes in thinking? And what was their impact on these programs?
Do you think that your going down was, how was it helpful?
My usual response to this question is to make the analogy with an iceberg. A little bit of the iceberg shows above the water. Most of it is underneath the water. I think that that part which is above the water has been changed very little, although some. But I think that there has been a real change which has occurred in the minds of the people, both the volunteers and the people the volunteers worked with. And I think that that real change is going to make a much more rapid change in the structure of Mississippi than people would have felt before the summer.
Ultimately, it will not be Northern volunteers who change the state of Mississippi, but Mississippians. And time and again, civil rights workers emphasize that changes must be made there.
Natürlich ist den Bürgerrechtsaktivisten klar, ein Wandel der Verhältnisse kann nur von den Mississippians selbst kommen. Dabei gab es eine kurze Zeit, in der die schwarze Bevölkerung ihre demokratischen Grundrechte in Mississippi ausüben konnte. Sie dauerte genau 10 Jahre. Danach begann im Süden der USA die weiße Konterrevolution, die in die amerikanische Geschichtsschreibung als Mississippi Plan einging. Seitdem hielt man Schwarze mit Schlägen, Einschüchterungen und Lynchmorden von der Wahlurne fern. Und seit 1890, als Mississippi seine Verfassung änderte, auch legal. Um sich in das Wahlregister einzutragen, musste nachgewiesen werden, dass alle Steuern bezahlt und eine sogenannte Wahlsteuer entrichtet worden war. Zum Gesetz gehörte auch der berüchtigte Literacy-Test, in dem die Antragsteller entweder aus der Verfassung vorlesen oder Stellen daraus auslegen mussten. Für viele Schwarze, die kaum die Schule besucht hatten, war das ein unüberwindbares Problem. Das galt übrigens genauso für die Armen unter den Weißen. Ob der Test bestanden wurde, entschied allein der rein weiße Wahlausschuss.
In 1876, Rutherford B. Hayes, the newly elected president of the United States, ordered the withdrawal of federal troops from Mississippi and from the South. That order, for all practical purposes, ended Negro participation in politics in Mississippi. With the troops gone and Reconstruction crumbling, white Mississippi began the counter-revolution, and the systematic violence that spread over the South became known commonly as the Mississippi Plan. These plans were simple: beatings, lynchings, and arson, to keep the Negroes from the polls. By 1901, the last Negro congressman from the South had left the House of Representatives. By 1920, the informal structure of terror was filled in with the steel and concrete of legislation, and the barrier separating the Negro from participation in the democratic processes was complete. The Mississippi Negro believes today that his freedom depends on his right to vote and to hold office. For both black and white, the stakes are high.
Why do you think it is that white people don't want the Negro to vote? Why does the white man not want you to vote?
Well, I would say it kind of like this. He know if you was had the same privilege to vote he have, you would have the chance, I would say, of voting for a man that you felt like, that would treat you, give you more justice than what he are giving you now. And if he didn't give you no more justice than what he are giving you now, you'll have a chance of helping to vote him out of that. The next question, you will have a chance, if for instance we had a Negro man would qualify to be the sheriff of Madison County. We would have the opportunity to vote for a Negro man to be the sheriff of Madison County. Yeah. And put him in office. And probably he would, if he win the election, he would give you a better justice than the other man given.
Mit dem Ausschluss aus dem demokratischen Prozess hatte die schwarze Bevölkerung keine Kontrolle über die Institutionen, von denen sie regiert wurde. In den 1960er Jahren waren 42% der Einwohner Mississippis Afroamerikaner. In den meisten Orten im Delta stellten sie die Mehrheit der Wahlberechtigten. Nur ein Bruchteil von ihnen war für die Wahl registriert. Sie hatten keine Möglichkeit, eigene Kandidaten zu wählen oder abzuwählen, sollten sie nicht für ihre Rechte eintreten.
Mississippi has almost 2.25 million citizens. 42% of these are Negro. And in the rich Delta counties in the southwestern parts of the state, the Negro is in the vast majority. Yet by every way by which we measure the decency of life, the Negro is far below the white. While Negro birth rates are half again as high as whites, the new Negro child is twice as likely as the white child to die in his first 5 years. He will probably have 6 years of education in inferior schools, while the white child will have 11 years in better schools. And after school, the young Negro will face a 50% greater chance of being unemployed. And should he work, the jobs open to him will be restricted to the most menial. They will generally be short-term, seasonal, marginal, and unreliable. His average income as an adult will be $606 a year, while the average income of the white child will be over $2,000 a year. And if the Negro is rural, his average income will be only $474. Only a third of the state's Negroes own their own homes, and two-thirds of the homes they live in are dilapidated. If the homes are in the rural areas, 75% are without running water, 90% have no flush toilets, no bathtubs or showers. Under such conditions, the Mississippi Negro and the Mississippi White see the struggle for the right to vote as revolutionary. It is attempted and met as such.
Eine der Gegenden Mississippis, in denen SNCC aktiv organisierte, war das Delta. Von den Studenten erfuhr die Pächterin Fannie Lou Hamer, dass sie ein Recht hatte, zu wählen. Hamer kam aus Ruleville, kaum 30 Meilen von Shaw entfernt. Wie die meisten Schwarzen hier hatte sie ihr Leben lang auf den Baumwollplantagen gearbeitet. Das Haus, in dem sie lebte, hatte sie von ihrem Arbeitgeber, einem Plantagenbesitzer, gepachtet. Fannie Lou Hamer ist eine von vielen Einwohnern Mississippis, die durch die Bewegung damals den Raum bekamen, um ihre eigene Stimme zu entwickeln. Innerhalb von 2 Jahren wird aus der Pächterin aus Ruleville eine Delegierte der neu gegründeten Freedom Democratic Party. Am Ende des Sommers werden Millionen von Amerikanern ihre Geschichte auf dem Kongress der Demokratischen Partei in Atlantic City live vor ihren Fernsehgeräten mitverfolgen. Es ist dieselbe Geschichte, die wir gleich hören werden, in der Hamer erzählt, wie es ihr ergangen ist, als sie 1962 mit 17 anderen nach Indianola fuhr, um sich in das Wahlregister einzutragen. Die Busfahrt hatte SNCC organisiert und begleitet.
It was the 31st of August in 1962 that 18 of us traveled 26 miles to the county courthouse in Indianola, Mississippi to try to register to become first-class citizens. We was met in Indianola with people with guns, plainclothes policemen. In fact, one of the things in the state of Mississippi you will find, anybody that can carry a gun and wear khaki clothes are police here. We was faced with those people and we went in to take this literacy test. We noticed during the time we was there, a state highway patrolman and a local policeman there, a city police, kept watching the bus that we was riding on. And after so long a time, after everybody had taken this literacy test, we started on our way back to Roseville. But we were stopped by the highway patrolman and the city police. We was carried back to Indianola. The bus driver was charged with driving a bus with the wrong color that day. It taken about $30 to get the bus driver out so he could bring us on back to Roseville. After we returned to Roseville, Reverend Jeff Sonny from Mount Bow, now Mississippi, carried me on out in the rural area where I had been living and working out there for 18 years as a timekeeper and a sharecropper. I was met by my daughter and my husband's cousin, and my daughter said, Mama said, this man is really hot, so I think you'll have to leave here. After she talked, I walked on inside of the house, and my husband walked up, and he told me that this man that I had worked for 18 years was really raising a lot of cane, and he believed I would have to leave. Before he had finished talking, this man came himself. He asked my husband, said, did you tell Fannie Lou what I said? And he said, I did. And I walked out of the house. He said, Fannie Lou, said you've been to the courthouse today. And I said, I did go. He said, I got 3 phone calls while you was there. He said, we are not ready for this in Mississippi. And I said, Mr. Marlowe, I said, I didn't register for you today. I was trying to register for myself. He said, well, you will have to leave. And I did have to leave that same night. We moved on this Lafayette Street the 3rd of December in 62. Our car was taken, and the most of our things had been stolen. But I'm determined, even in Roseville, to be free.
In Indianola können Fannie Lou Hamer und ihre Mitreisenden den Lese- und Schreibtest absolvieren. Als sie nach einigen Schikanen unterwegs am Abend zurück nach Ruleville kommt, erfährt Hamer, dass sie entlassen ist. Der Plantagenbesitzer sagt, Mississippi sei noch nicht so weit. Hamers Antwort darauf, ich habe mich heute nicht für Sie registrieren lassen. Ich habe es für mich getan. Sie verliert ihre Arbeit und ihr Zuhause. Im Juni 1963 wird sie auf der Rückfahrt von einem Workshop zur Wählerregistrierung festgenommen, ins Gefängnis gebracht und von 3 weißen und 2 schwarzen Männern mit Totschlägern fast umgebracht.
In 1963, the 3rd of January, we went to Charleston, South Carolina to a voter registration workshop. Returning from this voter registration workshop, the 9th of June when we arrived in Winona, Mississippi, was 6 of us arrested there. When we got to the county jail in Winona, Mississippi, they began placing the people in cells there. When they began placing them in cells, I was placed in a cell with Miss Yvesta Simpson. And I began to hear screams of people that was left in the booking room. And to see this woman when she passed my cell, that her clothes had been torn off. One of her eyes looked like blood. And she passed my cell unaware. I don't know how long it was before they came to my cell. But after a while, 3 white men came to my cell and asked me where I was from. And I told them I was from Roseville, Mississippi. And it wasn't too long before they came back. And they ordered me out of my cell. The state highway patrolman told me, he used a curse word, and said, "You are right, you are from Rue." And he called me an awful name. And he said, "We're going to make you wish you was dead." I was led out of that cell into another cell, where they had 2 Negro prisoners. 3 white men and 2 Negroes was in this cell. The state highway patrolman ordered the first Negro to take the blackjack. And I was ordered to lay down on my face. And the first Negro beat me until he was exhausted. He beat me until it was unbearable. And then the state highway patrolman ordered the second Negro to take the blackjack. And the second Negro taking the blackjack, I asked him, how could he do this? And the state highway patrolman ordered him to begin beating. When he began beating, I began to work my feet. And during the time I was working my feet, the state highway patrolman ordered the first Negro to set on my feet. And I was beat there until I was hard as metal. During that time, I was holding my hands behind me to try to keep the licks off the left side because I suffered from polio when I was 6 years old. During the time the second one was beating me, I was screaming. And during the time I was screaming, one of the white men got up and began to beat me in my head. And one of the policemen that was in that room walked over. I was trying to smooth my dress down. And he walked over and raised my dress as high as he could. And I was beat there in jail until I was hard as metal.
Attempts on the part of Negroes to register to vote have met with little success, and what success there has been token. Even when registered, the Negro is frequently kept from the polls, and if he finally casts a ballot, he is in any event kept from participation in the whole process by which candidates are chosen and platforms are adopted. In the face of this impasse, the Mississippi Negro turned, with the help of the Council of Federated Organizations, to the formation of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, whose development we will examine in our next program. There will be changes in Mississippi, and if the institutions currently in existence do not provide channels for change, then new ones will be created. For as Fannie Lou Hamer has said, the Negro is tired of life as it has been.
But we are tired now of killing. We are tired of being murdered and lynched for nothing. We are tired of the kids suffering from malnutrition. And we are tired of working for nothing. And we want a decent education in the state of Mississippi. We want better housing. And we want jobs.
Helmers Geschichte war kein Einzelfall. Fast jeder konnte sie so oder so ähnlich erzählen, der versucht hatte, sich ins Wahlregister einzutragen. Schon 1963 war deutlich geworden, es gab nicht genügend afroamerikanische Bürger, die das Risiko auf sich nehmen wollten oder konnten. Deswegen unternahmen die Bürgerrechtler einen weiteren klugen Schachzug, wie Chris Koch feststellt. Sie gründeten eine eigene Partei oder auch einen Ableger innerhalb der Demokratischen Partei, die Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party.
Well, I think the movement did a lot of really very smart things. When they discovered that they couldn't register voters to vote, that struggle was not going to work, they pivoted. Let's form our own party. And then the Freedom Democratic Party was formed, and that was transformational. Now people could really participate in a body that listened to what they had to say, you know, and many did.
Damit die Wähler bei den Bezirkswahlen über ihre Kandidaten der neuen Partei abstimmen konnten, mussten sie sich für die Freiheitswahl registrieren. Dafür gehen die Bürgerrechtsaktivisten von einer Tür zur nächsten. Nicht überall werden sie willkommen geheißen, aber jeder hat bereits von der MFDP gehört. Chris Koch gehört inzwischen mit zum Team.
Have you ever asked for a house of attempt already? Well, it's very great if you would go down. Have you ever thought about it?
Yeah, I've thought about it. I'm for it 100% on that.
Well, I mean, you tell me that. Well,
what happened to him?
I live in Mississippi. Mm-hmm. I've been living here all of my life. And this is what we're trying to do now. We're trying to get the white folks to see that. We want to come first class citizens.
We are with a team of voter registration workers canvassing homes outside of Canton, Mississippi. All morning we have been going up and down the back dirt roads, looking for driveways without gravel, avoiding those with gravel. For the county gravel is the driveway of whites throughout Mississippi, not Negroes. We have gone up the long dirt drives and sat on the porches or stood on the front steps talking with rural Negroes. It is perpetually hot and dusty. The shacks are uniformly gray and dilapidated. Sometimes we are warmly greeted. Sometimes we are asked to leave. Sometimes no one appears at all. Everyone tells us that they have heard of the Freedom Democratic Party, and some are willing to sign the freedom ballots. Others are afraid to do so and distrust us. This team of registrars consists of myself, a local Negro young man, and one of the white summer volunteers. The formation of the Freedom Democratic Party and the work to prepare for the convention challenge in Atlantic City was perhaps the crucial activity taken by COFO in the summer of 1964. This scene was taking place throughout the state, in towns and cities, in rural areas, on the huge plantations by night, and in safer spots by day.
Would you be interested in becoming a member of the Freedom Democratic Party?
I'll be interested, but I'll wait a while.
Fast eine halbe Million wahlberechtigter Afroamerikaner leben in Mississippi. Nach offiziellen Angaben waren von ihnen nur 5% als Wähler registriert. Überprüfen ließen sich die Angaben allerdings nicht, wie Donna Moses feststellt, die für den Aufbau der Freedom Democratic Party verantwortlich ist.
Can you tell me about how many people are involved in the voter registration drive and the Freedom Democratic registration drive?
This summer, I would say about 400 people, including, staff and the volunteers.
And what do they do?
This is Donna Moses, who is in charge of the voter registration drive for the Council of Federated Organizations.
Now, that hasn't been as prominent as the work on the challenge. That's gotten the emphasis this summer. And for that, people have been canvassing to get people freedom registered and also to get people out to precinct meetings.
Do you know offhand about how many Negroes are eligible in terms of age to vote?
About 425,000 in the state.
And how many of those are registered?
Their figures, that is the state's figures, are about 20,000. Now we don't really have a way of checking that, and we haven't been able to find those 20,000 in all of our work.
Die Gründung der Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party ist heute Geschichte. Teils entwickelten sich aus ihr andere Organisationen, teils gingen sie in der normalen demokratischen Partei auf. Damit diese sich aber überhaupt reformieren konnte, war die damalige Abspaltung notwendig. Die MFDP war nicht einfach eine Partei. Sie war ein Aufbegehren dagegen, dass die schwarze Bevölkerung bis dahin aus dem politischen Prozess ausgeschlossen war. Im April 1964 wurde Aaron Henry, ein Drogeriebesitzer aus Clarksdale, zu ihrem vorläufigen Vorsitzenden gewählt. Im Gespräch erzählt Henry, wie sie versucht haben, an den Bezirkstreffen der regulären Demokratischen Partei Mississippis teilzunehmen. Ohne Erfolg. Deswegen hatte Kofu zur Freiheitswahl aufgerufen. Und 80 bis 90.000 zumeist afroamerikanische Bürger folgten dem Aufruf. Damit widerlegten sie die Legende der weißen Rassisten, die schwarze Bevölkerung sei mit ihrer Situation zufrieden und hätte an Wahlen gar kein Interesse.
The method chosen by the Council of Federated Organizations to dramatize the Negroes' exclusion from voting and to create the framework to challenge that exclusion was the formation of the Freedom Democratic Party. It was officially established at a meeting in Jackson on April 26, 1964, when 300 delegates elected a temporary state executive committee and a temporary chairman, Aaron Henry. We asked Mr. Henry, a druggist in Clarksdale, about the background of the party.
So the roots of the Freedom Democratic Party really go back to the voter registrations attempts beginning around 4 years ago, is
that's
right?
True. Yes, that's true. That and out of the voter registration attempts, we have built somewhat a solid-based state organization from whence the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party is now nurturing.
Can you tell us about when was it decided to form the Freedom Democratic Party and who took part in those discussions?
Well, it's impossible, I think, to pinpoint a time, because ever since the Freedom Vote campaign, there has been this dialogue between a few of us, Bob Moses and myself, Aaron Henry, and David Dennis, who would I would say would be the three people on the local level. The Freedom Ballot came forward for generally two reasons. Number one was the large number of Negro people that had been denied the right to vote since we had embarked upon a voter registration campaign under the COFO label. We began a general campaign around 1960. It was accelerated in 62 with the Kona Foundation grant that revealed of around 69,000 people, Negro people, that had gone down to try to register, around 6,000 or 7,000 had gotten by, which was a terrible batting average. So we chose the Freedom Ballot activity as a method to dramatize that if Negroes were given the right to register, that they would accept it. And as it turned out, when this right was given unapprehended to a degree, of course, we had quite a bit of intimidation by the police department and other members of the power white structure, that as it turned out, however, there were between 80 and 90,000 people that did participate in this particular activity, which gave to us a real feeling of having been right in our continued position, that if Negroes were given the right to register, that they would accept it.
In fast allen 82 Bezirken finden Wahlen für die Freedom Democratic Party statt. Im ganzen Staat gibt es Massenkundgebungen und Demonstrationen, deren Ablauf sich überall ähnelt. Gemeinsames Singen, geduldiges Erklären. Und dann zum ersten Mal seit 100 Jahren haben die afroamerikanischen Bürger Mississippis eine Wahl.
Meetings took place throughout the state in the summer of 1964. They were voter registration rallies, mass meetings to plan marches and demonstrations, and most important, perhaps, the adoption of the democratic process to build a party structure. Precinct meetings were held where freedom-registered workers elected delegates for a county convention, and county conventions where delegates elected people for the district caucuses and the state convention in Jackson. Whatever the meeting, and under whatever circumstances, whether in the huge Masonic temple in Jackson, or the crowded, steamy Elk Hall in Greenwood, or the Quonset hut-like, unlighted, and unair-conditioned church in Greenville, or the tiny rural church in Holmes County, or under the open sky in a field 25 miles from Canton, they all held the same enthusiasm and followed essentially the same pattern. Lots of singing, patient explanations by the civil rights workers, and then, for the first time in 100 years, the use of the democratic process as Negro citizens were nominated, made speeches, and voted to elect their chosen representatives.
Jetzt hört in This Little Light Bob Moses sein Auftritt, der 1935 geborene Lehrer und Aktivist aus New York. Wir werden ihn im vierten Teil noch einmal hören, und zwar mit seinem heutigen Blick auf den Freedom Summer. Hier spricht er auf einer Wahlveranstaltung darüber, dass Rassentrennung längst nicht das einzige Problem ist.
We have been able around the sit-ins and the wait-ins and the demonstrations for public accommodations to pose a very sharp question. And finally, with the passage of the Civil Rights Bill, to get a very clear answer.
Every speaker, every registration worker has a different style. This is Bob Moses, the program director for COFO, speaking before 2,000 people at a mass meeting that was used, in part, as a workshop for forthcoming precinct meetings in Jackson.
But it is also clear that the answer given by the Civil Rights Bill by no means touches the real problems that face the Negro. Problems of jobs, schools, of housing, problems of the poor. The real question is the country and the Democratic Party prepared to give a clear response? Now, it seems to me that the Democratic Party of this country and the people of this country have but just one real answer to give, and that is that the country has no more place for racism in its presidential parties than it has in the congressional parties. That the Democratic Party must forge anew in the South a new party structure not based on race or racism, but which encompasses all the people who are ready to give service to its programs. Now, this demands on the part of the Negro people who live in Mississippi a different kind of work than they've been called upon to do before. I don't believe that the people are not ready to work. I do believe that their leaders have not called upon them to work in the way in which they should. And this demands from you not only that you march with your feet in the streets, but that you sit down and you think with your heads in your rooms and in your meetings, and that you not be afraid, and above all, that you not be ashamed, because what we're calling for now is the emergence of the people who have been submerged by before now.
Die eigentliche Frage, so Bob Moses, muss lauten: Was tun die Nation und die Demokratische Partei gegen den strukturellen und institutionalisierten Rassismus in ihren eigenen Reihen? Im Anschluss hören wir Donna Moses, die den Ablauf und die Bedeutung der Wahl für die Repräsentanten der Mississippi Freedom Party erklärt. In einer Wahl, in der es keine Lesetests mehr gibt, in der jeder das Recht hat, selbst zu wählen. Damit nimmt die Wahl den Voting Rights Act vorweg, der erst ein Jahr später von der Regierung Lyndon B. Johnsons verabschiedet wird und allen Bürgern der USA das Wahlrecht gewährleisten soll.
Now, the way people become eligible to participate in precinct meetings is to fill out the Freedom Registration Form.
Donna Moses, who you heard earlier, and who is heading up the voter registration project in Mississippi, spoke specifically of the process that would have to be followed.
On the official books, with the regular Democratic Party in this state, the way you become eligible, that is for white people, to be in their precinct meetings is to be on the regular registration books. Well, most of you aren't on the regular registration books, and that's not your fault. Some of you aren't on the books because you've been told what'll happen to you if you try to go down. Some of you aren't on the books because you don't think you can pass that test. Now, a lot of you can't, and that again is not your fault. I'm not going to go into all of those reasons. You know them better than I do. Now, on the Freedom Registration Form, there are only 9 questions. and they just get at the facts that we need to know, like what your name is, where you live, how long you've been living in Mississippi, that kind of thing. And that's all. There's no interpretation of the Mississippi Constitution. Now, there's one more very important thing, and that is that even illiterate people can sign up on the freedom registration forms. And that's because we believe that even if you can't read and write, you can determine who you want to rule over you and to govern you. You have a right to determine those things. People don't have a right to do it for you.
We shall overcome. Every meeting in Mississippi, every convention, every rally, every demonstration ends with this song of the movement. When civil rights workers are packed in trucks and carried off to jail, this song, perhaps raggedy and unsteadily, comes from those buses. At times the sound is timid, at times it is off-key and out of tune. In massive halls it rings like justice itself. But from this mass meeting in Greenwood to the county convention in Madison, it is the same song with the same meaning.
Mit der Gründung der MFDP gibt es in Mississippi zwei demokratische Parteien. Beide tagen im Sommer 1964 in Jackson. Es ist die letzte Vorbereitung auf den Bundesparteitag der Demokraten Ende August in Atlantic City. Die Frage ist, welche Partei wird dort die Wähler Mississippis vertreten? Und welche Wähler? Beide Parteitage finden unter den aufmerksamen Blicken einer medialen Öffentlichkeit statt. Damit enden aber auch schon die Gemeinsamkeiten.
Those are the themes that opened the state conventions of the Freedom Democratic Party and the regular Democratic Party of Mississippi. The differences between the two parties are shown most strikingly, perhaps, by their two state conventions, both held in Jackson.
Auf dem Podium der Freedom Democratic Party steht Ella Baker. Sie war die treibende Kraft hinter dem politischen Programm von SNCC. In ihrer Rede rechnet Baker mit der Oligarchie im Süden der USA ab. Mit ihren Lügen, mit denen sie Glauben machen wollte, sie könnte das Rassenproblem und die Assimilation auf ihre Weise lösen. Dabei hatte der Rest des Landes zugesehen und aus taktischen Gründen bestehende Gesetze nie gegen die Südstaaten angewendet. Aber Baker kritisiert auch die schwarze Bevölkerung im Süden, die sich über Generationen mit der Rassentrennung eingerichtet hatte. Anders als die gegenwärtige Generation, als tausende schwarze Studenten überall im Süden für Hotdogs demonstrierten. Dabei ging es nicht nur um das Essen von Hotdogs, sondern um ihr individuelles Recht, diese jederzeit und überall essen zu können, ohne Einschränkung. Der Widerstand der Studenten läutete auch das Ende einer schwarzen Führung ein, die Weißen zu lange entgegengekommen war. Dabei geht es Baker nicht nur um die Frage der Hautfarbe, sondern auch um die der Klasse.
The fact that the South has existed as an oligarchy ever since Reconstruction days, and it has been an oligarchy that has fed the people with the big lies that gave them to believe that the South could deal with the problem of race and the problem of racial assimilation as it wanted to. A second aspect of our problem, I believe, is the fact that after the South had been given this, established itself in this respect, the rest of the country tacitly agreed, despite the deprivation of the right to vote on the part of all southern states for a long period of time, At no point were the southern states denied their representation on the basis of the fact that they had denied other people the right to participate in the election of those who govern them. And the Constitution provided for this opportunity. The third factor that helped to contribute to our present state for a long time was the fact that Negroes, those of us of my generation and generations before me, were accommodating themselves to segregation in ways that you of this generation refuse to do. But the signal for the day of accommodation came in 1960, when throughout the Southland, apparently without rhyme or reason, area after area, hundreds of students, and yes, thousands of Negro students, began to demonstrate for hot dogs. But it wasn't just hot dogs they were demonstrating for. They were demonstrating for the right of an individual to eat a hot dog if he wanted to, if it had the money to pay for it, and not be relegated to a second-class status because of the color of his skin. And this spelt the death knell of the accommodating type of Negro leadership. You're here because you believe and you know that your life and the lives of all the people of this state have been hamstrung, have been limited, and both white and Negro, if you please, by the very fact that Mr. Eastland and other politicians like Ross Barnett and even your present governor have subscribed to the theory and practice of racism first and anything else afterwards. And so, when we say that what you do here today is important, we said that it's not only important to you and to the Negro people of Mississippi, it's important to the white people of Mississippi, because in breaking the chains of political stranglehold on you, you helped to liberate the poor whites of Mississippi. You helped to bring Mississippi into the 20th century, where it faces the fact that we are living in an atomic age and not a horse and buggy or an ox cart age. And this is...
Ella Baker beschwört den Aufschluss der Südstaaten an die amerikanische Gegenwart. Sie nennt es das Atomzeitalter. Währenddessen erklärt Gouverneur Paul Johnson auf dem Parteitag der regulären Demokratischen Partei Mississippi zum ideologischen Schlachtfeld der USA. Die anstehende Präsidentenwahl im November stilisiert er zur letzten Schlacht, in der es gilt, den Glauben und die Institutionen und Rechte Mississippis gegen die tyrannische Zentralmacht Washingtons zu verteidigen. Das hört sich heute kaum anders an. Und auch die warnenden Worte an die Delegierten klingen nur allzu bekannt. Jedes unvorsichtig geäußerte Wort könnte nationale Schlagzeilen in den Zeitungen New Yorks und Washingtons nach sich ziehen. Oder im nationalen Fernsehen von Propagandisten aufgeblasen und verdreht gegen Mississippi verwendet werden. Die Medien als Feinde und die Selbststilisierung zum Opfer. Diese Folge von This Little Light endet also mit einer weißen Stimme, aus der die Entschlossenheit spricht, den Status quo um jeden Preis zu verteidigen.
The keynote speaker at the regular convention was Governor Paul B. Johnson, who was introduced to still another playing of Dixie, and who left with a demonstration of his own as delegates rose from their seats and sung and applauded to the old Southern song.
Frankly, I feel as some others do, and I've never written many speeches in my lifetime, and I would like to throw away what I have written and really speak. But I know that with conditions prevalent in the state and the nation at this time that I had better hang close to the script. There may have been times in the past when it did not make much difference what the delegates to a state political party convention said or did. But on this, the 28th day of July, 1964, the actions you take and the words you speak are weighted with a frightening importance. Mississippians, we are in a struggle for the very survival of those beliefs and institutions, states' rights and constitutional government, which protect individual liberty from the tyranny of centralized power. That centralized power in the national capital. The 1964 campaign will culminate in November in what might be, in what threatens to be, the last free election in this fair land of ours. In this campaign, Mississippi will have a role far greater than her 7 electoral votes. For in the great national debate, the mass media of information have made of Mississippi a symbol, and the actions of the federal government have made our state an ideological battleground. As a result, Mississippi is news. Anything which happens in Mississippi and which can be made to appear damaging to our point of view and our principles will be printed and broadcast to the entire national audience and beyond. I do not need to remind you that one release of pent-up feelings in this hall can result in a big black damaging headline in the metropolitan newspapers across this nation, or that one intemperate phrase uttered here can be heard this very evening on the national television networks. Magnified and twisted by skillful propagandists unfriendly to Mississippi and everything she stands for.
Nachdem wir heute von den Aufbrüchen in Mississippi gehört haben, dem ersten Schulboykott, Fannie Lou Hamers steinigem Weg, sich als Wählerin zu registrieren und von der Gründung einer neuen Partei, erwartet uns in der nächsten Sendung der Showdown der beiden demokratischen Parteien Mississippis auf dem Bundesparteitag in Atlantic City. Und wir widmen uns der Frage, was aus dem Freedom Summer geworden ist und wie seine Ziele heute weiter verfolgt werden. Dazu sprechen neben dem Autor Chris Koch auch der Aktivist Bob Moses, den wir zusammen mit seiner Tochter Maisha 50 Jahre nach der Sendung von This Little Light getroffen haben.
This Little Light, eine Radioserie aus dem Jahr 1964 von Chris Koch. Neu gehört und in Ausschnitten präsentiert von Martina Groß. Teil 3: Aufbrüche. Ton: Thomas Monajan. Regieassistenz: Vivian Schütz. Produktion: Deutschlandfunk Kultur 2018.